The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sergyal Rinpoche.
For all its technological achievements, modern Western society has no real understanding of death, or what happens in death, or after death. People today are taught to deny death, and taught that it means nothing but annihilation and loss. That means that most of the world lives either in denial of death, or in terror of it. Even talking about death is considered morbid. Many people believe that simply mentioning death is to risk wishing it upon ourselves. Others look on death with a naive, thoughtless cheerfulness, thinking that for some unknown reason, death will work out all right for them, and that it is nothing to worry about. One Tibetan master says, "People often make the mistake of being frivolous about death and think, oh, well, death happens to everybody, it's no big deal, it's natural, I'll be fine." That's a nice theory, until one is dying. The disastrous effects of the denial of death go far beyond the individual. They affect the whole planet. Fear of death and ignorance of the afterlife are fueling that destruction of our environment that is threatening all of our lives. So isn't it all the more disturbing that people are not taught what death is, or how to die, or given any hope in what lies after death, and so what really lies behind life? According to the wisdom of Buddha, we can actually use our lives to prepare for death. In the Buddhist approach, life and death are seen as one whole, where death is the beginning of another chapter of life. Death is a mirror in which the entire meaning of life is reflected. This view is central to the teachings of the most ancient school of Tibetan Buddhism. In these teachings, we find the whole of life and death presented together as a series of constantly changing transitional realities known as bardos. The word bardo is commonly used to denote the intermediate state between death and rebirth, but in reality, bardos are occurring continuously throughout both life and death, and they are junctures when the possibility of liberation or enlightenment is heightened. Because of the vastness and all-comprehensiveness of the bardo teachings, you will be guided stage by stage through the unfolding vision of the journey through life and death. Our exploration necessarily begins with a direct reflection on what death means and the many facets of the truth of impermanence. The kind of reflection that can enable us to make rich use of this life while we still have time and ensure that when we die, it will be without remorse or self-recrimination at having wasted our lives. As Tibet's famous poet saint Milarepa said, "My religion is to live and die without regret." Contemplating deeply on the secret message of impermanence, what lies in fact beyond impermanence and death, leads directly to the heart of the ancient and powerful Tibetan teachings, the introduction to the essential nature of mind. Realization of the nature of mind, which you could call our innermost essence, the truth which we all search for, is the key to understanding life and death. For what happens at the moment of death is that the ordinary mind and its delusions die, and in that gap, the boundless skylight nature of our mind is uncovered. This essential nature of mind is the background to the whole of life and death, like the sky which holds the whole universe in its embrace. The teachings make it clear that if all we know of mind is the aspect of mind that dissolves when we die, we will be left with no idea of what continues, no knowledge of the new dimension of the deeper reality of the nature of mind. So it is vital for us all to familiarize ourselves with the nature of mind while we are still alive. Only then will we be prepared when it reveals itself spontaneously and powerfully at the moment of death. The bardo teachings show us precisely what will happen if we prepare for death and what will happen if we do not. The choice could not be clearer. If we refuse to accept death now, while we are still alive, we will pay dearly throughout our lives, at the moment of death, and thereafter. The effects of this refusal will ravage this life and all the lives to come. We will not be able to live our lives fully. We will remain imprisoned in the very aspect of ourselves that has to die. This ignorance will rob us of the basis of the journey to enlightenment and trap us endlessly in the realm of illusion, the uncontrolled cycle of birth and death, the ocean of suffering that we Buddhists call samsara. Yet the fundamental message of the Buddhist teachings is that if we are prepared, there is tremendous hope, both in life and in death. The teachings reveal to us the possibility of an astounding and finally boundless freedom, which is ours to work for now in life. The freedom that will also enable us to choose our death, and so to choose our birth. For someone who has prepared and practiced, death comes not as a defeat, but as a triumph, the crowning and most glorious moment of life. Death is a vast mystery, but there are two things we can say about it. It is absolutely certain that we will die, and it is uncertain when or how we will die. The only surety we have, then, is this uncertainty about the hour of our death, which we seize on as the excuse to postpone facing death directly. Perhaps the deepest reason why we are afraid of death is because we do not know who we are. We believe in a personal, unique, and separate identity, but if we dare to examine it, we find that this identity depends entirely on an endless collection of things to prop it up. Our name, our biography, our partners, family, home, job, friends, credit cards. It is on their fragile and transient support that we rely for our security. So when they're all taken away, will we have any idea of who we really are? When we die, we leave everything behind, especially this body we have cherished so much and relied upon so blindly and tried so hard to keep alive. But our minds are no more dependable than our bodies. Just look at your mind for a few minutes. You will see that it's like a flea, constantly hopping to and fro. You will see that thoughts arise without any reason, without any connection. Swept along by the chaos of every moment, we are the victims of the fickleness of our mind. If this is the only state of consciousness we are familiar with, then to rely on our minds at the moment of death is an absurd gamble. Our myopic focus on this life, and this life only, is the great deception, the source of the modern world's bleak and destructive materialism. No one talks about death. No one talks about the afterlife because people are made to believe that such talk will only thwart our so-called progress in the world. Our lives seem to live us, to possess their own bizarre momentum, to carry us away. In the end, we feel we have no choice or control over them. As the 18th century Tibetan master Jigpe Lingpa said, mesmerized by the sheer variety of perceptions, beings wander endlessly astray in samsara's vicious circle. It is important to reflect calmly, again and again, that death is real and comes without warning. Don't be like the pigeon in the Tibetan proverb. He spends all night fussing about, making his bed, and dawn comes up before he has even had time to go to sleep. One of the chief reasons we have so much anguish and difficulty facing death is that we ignore the truth of impermanence. We so desperately want everything to continue as it is that we have to believe that things will always stay the same. But this is only make-believe. And as we so often discover, belief has little or nothing to do with reality. Reflect on this. The realization of impermanence is paradoxically the only thing we can hold on to, perhaps our only lasting possession. It's like the sky or the earth. No matter how much everything around us may change or collapse, they endure. Whenever we lose our perspective or fall prey to laziness, reflecting on death and impermanence shakes us back into the truth. What is born will die. What has been gathered will be dispersed. What has been accumulated will be exhausted. What has been built up will collapse. And what has been high will be brought low. Isn't everything always changing? The leaves on the trees in the park, the light in your room as you listen to this, the seasons, the weather, the time of day, people passing you on the street. And what about us? The cells of our body are dying, the neurons in our brain are decaying, even the expression on our face is always changing depending on our mood. What we call our basic character is only a mind stream, nothing more. Today we feel good because things are going well. Tomorrow we feel the opposite. Where did that good feeling go? New influences took us over as circumstances changed. We are impermanent, the influences are impermanent, and there is nothing solid or lasting anywhere that we can point to. What could be more unpredictable than our thoughts and emotions? Do you have any idea what you're going to think or feel next? Our mind, in fact, is as empty, as impermanent, and as transient as a dream. Look at a thought. It comes, stays, and it goes. The past is past, the future not yet risen, and even the present thought, as we experience it, becomes the past. The only thing we really have is nowness, is now. In Tibet, there is the story of Krishagatami, a young woman who had the good fortune to live at the time of the Buddha. When her firstborn child was about a year old, it fell ill and died. Grief-stricken and clutching its little body, Krishagatami roamed the streets begging anyone she met for a medicine that could restore her child to life. Some ignored her, some laughed at her, some thought she was mad. And finally, she met a wise man who told her that the only person in the world who could perform the miracle she was looking for was the Buddha. So she went to the Buddha, laid the body of her child at his feet, and told him her story. The Buddha listened with infinite compassion, and then he said gently, "There is only one way to heal your affliction. Go down to the city and bring me back a mustard seed from any house in which there has never been a death." Krishagatami felt elated, and she set off at once for the city, and she stopped at the first house she saw, and she said, "I've been told by the Buddha to fetch a mustard seed from a house that has never known death. Many people have died in this house," she was told. So she went on to the next house. "Oh, there have been countless deaths in our family," they said, and so on to a third and a fourth house, until she had been all round the city and realized the Buddha's condition could not be fulfilled. She took the body of her child to the charnel ground and said goodbye to him for the last time, and then returned to the Buddha. "Did you bring the mustard seed?" he asked. "No," she said. "I am beginning to understand the lesson you're trying to teach me. The grief made me blind, and I thought that only I had suffered at the hands of death." "Why have you come back?" asked the Buddha. "To ask you to teach me the truth," she replied, "of what death is, what might lie behind and beyond death, and what in me, if anything, will not die." The Buddha began to teach her, "If you want to know the truth of life and death, you must reflect continually on this. There is only one law in the universe that never changes, that all things change, and that all things are impermanent. The death of your child has helped you to see now that the realm that we are in, samsara, is an ocean of unbearable suffering. There is one way, and only one way, out of samsara's ceaseless round of birth and death, which is the path to liberation. Because pain has now made you ready to learn, and your heart is opening to the truth, I will show it to you." Krishagatami knelt at his feet and followed the Buddha for the rest of her life. Near the end of it, it is said, she attained enlightenment. Krishna Gotami's story shows us something we can observe again and again. A close encounter with death can bring a real awakening, a transformation in our whole approach to life. Frida Naylor, a doctor who courageously kept a diary as she died of cancer, wrote, "I have had experiences which I never would have had, for which I have to thank the cancer. Humility, coming to terms with my own mortality, knowledge of my inner strength, which continually surprises me, and more things about myself which I have discovered because I've had to stop in my tracks, reassess, and proceed." If we can indeed reassess and proceed with this newfound humility and openness, and a real acceptance of our death, we will find ourselves much more receptive to spiritual instructions and spiritual practice. This receptivity could well open to us yet another marvelous possibility, that of true healing. Tibetan Buddhists believe that illnesses like cancer can be a warning, to remind us that we have been neglecting deep aspects of our being, such as our spiritual needs. If we take this warning seriously and change fundamentally the direction of our lives, there is a very real hope for healing not only our bodies, but our whole being. The purpose of reflecting on death is to make a real change in the depth of your heart. Looking into death needn't be frightening or morbid. Why not reflect on death when you are really inspired, relaxed and comfortable, lying in bed or on holiday or listening to music that particularly delights you? Why not reflect on it when you're happy, in good health, confident, full of well-being? Don't you notice that there are particular moments when you are naturally moved to introspection? Work with them gently, for these are the moments when you can go through a powerful experience and your whole world view can change quickly. Contemplation on death will bring you a deepening sense of what we call renunciation, in Tibetan, Nejung. Ne means actually or definitely, and Jung means to come out, emerge, or be born. The fruit of frequent and deep reflection on death will be that you will find yourself emerging, often with a sense of disgust from your habitual patterns. You will find yourself increasingly ready to let go of them, and in the end you will be able to free yourself from them as smoothly, the masters say, as drawing a hair from a slab of butter. This renunciation that you will come to has both sadness and joy in it. Sadness, because you realize the futility of your old ways, and joy, because of the greater vision that begins to unfold when you are able to let go of them. This is no ordinary joy. It's a joy that gives birth to a new and profound strength, a confidence, an abiding inspiration that comes from the realization that you are not condemned to your habits, and that you can indeed emerge from them, that you can change and grow more and more free. There would be no chance at all of getting to know death if it happened only once. But fortunately, life is nothing but a continuing dance of birth and death, a dance of change. So let us then work with these changes now in life. That is the real way to prepare for death. Life may be full of pain, suffering, and difficulty, but all of these are opportunities handed to us to help us move towards an emotional acceptance of death. It is only when we believe things to be permanent that we shut off the possibility of learning from change. If we shut off this possibility, we become closed and we become grasping. Grasping is the source of all our problems. Since impermanence to us spells anguish, we grasp onto things desperately, even though all things change. We are terrified of letting go, terrified, in fact, of living at all, since learning to live is learning to let go. And this is the tragedy and irony of our struggle to hold on. Not only is it impossible, but it brings us the very pain that we are seeking to avoid.
Look still deeper into impermanence, and you will find that it has another message, another face, one of great hope, one that opens your eyes to the fundamental nature of the universe and our extraordinary relationship to it. If everything is impermanent, then everything is what we call empty, which means lacking in any lasting, stable, and inherent existence. And all things, when seen and understood in their true relation, are not independent, but interdependent with all other things. The Buddha compared the universe to a vast net woven of countless variety of brilliant jewels, each with a countless number of facets. Each jewel reflects in itself every other jewel in the net and is, in fact, one with every other jewel. Think of a wave in the sea. Seen in one way, it seemed to have a distinct identity, an end and a beginning, a birth and a death. But seen in another way, the wave itself doesn't really exist, but is just the behavior of the water, empty of any separate identity, but full of water. So when you really think about the wave, you come to realize that it is something made temporarily possible by wind and water and is dependent on a set of constantly changing circumstances. You also realize that every wave is related to every other wave. Nothing has any inherent existence of its own. When you really look at it, and this absence of independent existence is what we call emptiness. Think of a tree. When you think of a tree, you tend to think of a distinctly defined object. And on a certain level, like the wave, it is. But when you look more closely at the tree, you will see that ultimately it has no independent existence. When you contemplate it, you will find that it dissolves into an extremely subtle net of relationships that stretches across the universe. The rain that falls on its leaves, the wind that sways it, the soil that nourishes and sustains it, and all the seasons and the weather, the moonlight and the starlight and sunlight, all form part of this tree. As you begin to think about the tree more and more, you will discover that everything in the universe helps to make the tree what it is, and that it cannot in any moment be isolated from anything else, and that at every moment its nature is subtly changing. And this is what we mean when we say things are empty and they have no independent existence. Modern science speaks to us of an extraordinary range of interrelations. Ecologists know that a tree burning in the Amazon rainforest alters in some way the air breathed by the citizens of Paris, and that the trembling of the butterfly's wing in Yucatan affects the life of a fern in Hebrides. Biologists are beginning to uncover the fantastic and complex dance of genes that creates personality and identity, a dance that stretches far into the past and shows that each so-called identity is composed of a swirl of different influences. Physicists have introduced us to the world of quantum particles, a world astonishing, like described by the Buddha in his image of the glittering net that unfolds across the universe. Just like the jewels in the net, all particles exist potentially as different combinations of other particles. So when we really look at ourselves, then, and the things around us, we took to be so solid, so stable, and so lasting, we find that they have no more reality than a dream. Buddha said, "Know all things to be like this, a mirage, a cloud castle, a dream, an apparition, without essence, but with the qualities that can be seen. Know all things to be like this, as the moon in a bright sky, in some clear lake reflected, though to that lake the moon has never moved. Know all things to be like this, as an echo that derives from music, sound, and weeping, yet in that echo is no melody. Know all things to be like this, as a magician makes illusions of horses, oxen, carts, and other things. Nothing is as it appears. Contemplation of this dreamlike quality of reality need not in any way make us cold, hopeless, or embittered. On the contrary, it can open up in us a warm humor, a soft and strong compassion we hardly knew we possessed, and so more and more generosity toward all things and beings. The great Tibetan saint Milarepa said, "Seeing emptiness, have compassion." When through contemplation we really have seen the emptiness and interdependence of all things in ourselves, the world is revealed in a brighter, fresher, and more sparkling light as the infinitely reflecting net of jewels that Buddha spoke of. We no longer have to protect ourselves or pretend, and it becomes increasingly easy to do what one Tibetan master has advised. Always recognize the dreamlike quality of life and reduce attachment and aversion. Practice good-heartedness toward all beings. Be loving and compassionate, no matter what others do to you. What they will do will not matter so much when you see it as a dream. The trick is to have the positive intention during the dream. This is the essential point. This is true spirituality. True spirituality also is to be aware that if we are interdependent with everything and everyone else, even our smallest, least significant thought, word, and action have real consequences throughout the universe. Throw a pebble into a pond, it sends a shiver across the surface of the water. Ripples merge into one another and create new ones. Everything is inextricably interrelated. We come to realize that we are responsible for everything we do, say, or think, responsible, in fact, for ourselves, everyone and everything else, and the entire universe. The Dalai Lama has said, "In today's highly interdependent world, individuals and nations can no longer resolve many of their problems by themselves. We need one another. We must therefore develop a sense of universal responsibility. It is our collective and individual responsibility to protect and nurture the global family, to support its weaker members, and to preserve and tend to the environment in which we all live." Impermanence has already revealed to us many truths, but it has a final treasure still in its keeping, one that lies largely hidden from us, unsuspected and unrecognized, yet most intimately our own. The Western poet Rainer Maria Rilke has said that our deepest fears are like the dragons guarding our deepest treasure. The fear that impermanence awakens in us, that nothing is real, that nothing lasts, is, we come to discover, our greatest friend, because it drives us to ask, if everything dies and changes, then what is really true? Is there something behind the appearances, something boundless and infinitely spacious, something in which the dance of change and impermanence takes place? Is there something, in fact, we can depend on that does survive what we call death? Allowing these questions to occupy us urgently and reflecting on them, we slowly find ourselves making a profound shift in the way we view everything. With continued contemplation and practice in letting go, we come to uncover in ourselves something we cannot name or describe or conceptualize, something we begin to realize lies behind all the changes and the deaths of the world. The narrow desires and the distractions to which our obsessive grasping onto permanence has condemned us begin to dissolve and fall away. As this happens, we catch repeated and glowing glimpses of the vast implications behind the truth of impermanence. It is as if all our lives we've been flying in an airplane through the dark clouds and turbulence, when suddenly the plane soars above these into the clear, boundless sky. Inspired and exhilarated by this emergence into a new dimension of freedom, we come to uncover a depth of peace, joy and confidence in ourselves that fills us with wonder and breeds in us gradually a certainty that there is something that nothing destroys, that nothing alters, and that cannot die. As Milarepa wrote, "In horror of death, I took to the mountains. Again and again, I meditated on the uncertainty of the hour of death. Capturing the fortress of the deathless, unending nature of mind, now all fear of death is over and done." Gradually then, we become aware in ourselves of the calm and sky-like presence of what Milarepa calls the deathless, unending nature of mind. And as this new awareness begins to become vivid and almost unbroken, there occurs what the Upanishads call a turning about in the seat of consciousness. A personal, utterly non-conceptual revelation of what we are, why we are here, and how we should act, which amounts in the end to nothing less than a new life, a new birth, almost, you could say, a resurrection. What a beautiful and what a healing mystery it is that from contemplating continually and fearlessly the truth of change and impermanence, we come slowly to find ourselves face to face in gratitude and joy with the truth of changeless, with the truth of deathless, unending nature of mind. The true revolutionary insight of Buddhism is that life and death are in the mind and nowhere else. Mind is revealed as the universal basis of experience, the creator of happiness and the creator of suffering, the creator of what we call life and what we call death. There are many aspects to the mind, but two stand out. The first is the ordinary mind, called by the Tibetan Sem. One master defines it, "That which possesses discriminating awareness, that which possesses a sense of duality, which grasps or rejects something external, that is mind. Fundamentally, it is that which can associate with an other, with any something that is perceived as different from the perceiver." Sem is the discursive, dualistic thinking mind which can only function in relation to a projected and falsely perceived external reference point. So, Sem is the mind that thinks, plots, desires, manipulates, that flares up in anger, that creates and indulges in waves of negative emotions and thoughts, that has to go on and on asserting, validating, and confirming its existence by fragmenting, conceptualizing, and solidifying experience. The ordinary mind is the ceaselessly shifting and shiftless prey of external influences, habitual tendencies, and conditioning. The masters liken them to a candle flame in an open doorway, vulnerable to all the winds of circumstance. Seen from one angle, Sem is flickering, unstable, grasping, and endlessly minding others' business, its energy consumed by projecting outwards. I think of it as sometimes as a Mexican jumping bean, or as a monkey hopping restlessly from branch to branch on a tree. Yet seen in another way, the ordinary mind has a false, dull stability, a smug and self-protective inertia, a stone-like calm of ingrained habits. Sem is as cunning as a crooked politician, skeptical, distrustful, expert at trickery and guile, ingenious, Jaman Kenser wrote, in the games of deception. It is within the experience of this chaotic, confused, undisciplined and repetitive sem, this ordinary mind, that again and again we undergo change and death. Then there is the very nature of mind, its innermost essence, which is absolutely and always untouched by change or death. At present, it is hidden within our own mind, our sem, enveloped and obscured by the mental scurry of our thought and emotions. Just as clouds can be shifted by a strong gust of wind to reveal the shining and wide open sky, so under certain special circumstances, some inspiration may uncover for us glimpses of this nature of mind. These glimpses have many depths and degrees, but each of them will bring some light of understanding, meaning and freedom. This is because the nature of mind is the very root itself of understanding. In Tibetan, we call it Rigpa, a primordial, pure, pristine awareness that is at once intelligent, cognizant, radiant, and always awake. It could be said to be the knowledge of knowledge itself. Do not make the mistake of imagining that the nature of mind is exclusive to our mind only. It is, in fact, the nature of everything. It can never be said too often that to realize the nature of mind is to realize the nature of all things. Saints and mystics throughout the history have adorned their realization with different names and given them different faces and interpretations. But what they are all fundamentally experiencing is the essential nature of the mind. The Christians and Jews call it God. The Hindus call it the Self, the Shiva, the Brahman, and the Vishnu. Sufi mystics name it the hidden essence. The Buddhists call it the Buddha nature. At the heart of all religions is the certainty that there is a fundamental truth, and this life is a sacred opportunity to evolve and realize it. When we say Buddha, we naturally think of the Indian prince Gautama Siddhartha, who reached enlightenment in the 6th century BC, and who taught the spiritual path followed by millions all over Asia, known today as Buddhism. Buddha, however, has a much more deeper meaning. It means a person, any person, who has completely awakened from ignorance and opened to his or her vast potential of wisdom. A Buddha is one who has brought a final end to suffering and frustration and discovered a lasting and deathless happiness and peace. But for many of us in the skeptical age, the state may seem like a fantasy or a dream or an achievement far beyond our reach. It is important to remember always that Buddha was a human being like you or me. He never claimed divinity. He merely knew he had the Buddha nature, the seed of enlightenment, and that everyone else did too. The Buddha nature is simply the birthright of every sentient being. And I always say, our Buddha nature is as good as any Buddha's Buddha nature. This is the good news that Buddha brought us from his enlightenment in Buddhagaya, and which many people find so inspiring. His message that enlightenment is within the reach of all holds out tremendous hope. Through practice, we too can all become awakened. And if this were not true, countless individuals down to the present day would not have become enlightened. It is said that when Buddha attained enlightenment, all he wanted to do was to show the rest of us the nature of mind and share completely what he had realized. But he also saw, with the sorrow of infinite compassion, how difficult it would be for us to understand. For even though we have the same inner nature as the Buddha, we have not recognized it because it is so enclosed and wrapped up in our ordinary individual minds. Imagine an empty vase. The space inside is exactly the same as outside. Only the fragile walls of the vase separate one from the other. Our Buddha mind is enclosed within the walls of our ordinary mind, but when we become enlightened, it is as if that vase shatters into pieces. The space inside merges instantly into the space outside, and they become one. There and then we realize that they were never separate or different. They were always the same. So whatever our lives are like, our Buddha nature is always there. And it is always perfect. We say that not even the Buddhas can improve it in their infinite wisdom, nor can sentient beings spoil it in their seemingly infinite confusion. Our true nature could be compared to the sky and the confusion of the ordinary mind to clouds. Someday the sky is completely obscured by clouds, and when we are down on the ground looking up, it is very difficult to believe that there is anything else there but clouds. Yet we only have to fly in a plane to discover up above a limitless expanse of clear blue sky. From up there, the clouds we assumed were everything seemed so small and so far down below. We should always try and remember the clouds are not the sky and do not belong to it. They only hang there and pass by in their slightly ridiculous and non-dependent fashion. And they can never stain or mark the sky in any way. So, where exactly is this Buddha nature? It is in the sky-like nature of our mind, utterly open, free and limitless. It is fundamentally so simple and so natural that it can never be complicated or corrupted or stained, so pure that it is beyond even the concept of purity and impurity. To talk of this nature mind as sky-like, of course, is only a metaphor that helps us to begin to imagine its all-embracing boundlessness. For the Buddha nature has a quality the sky cannot have, that of a radiant clarity of awareness. As it is said, it is simply your flawless, present awareness, cognizant and empty, naked and awake. Dujumabachi wrote, no words can describe it, no example can point to it. Samsara does not make it worse, Nirvana does not make it better. It has never been born, it has never ceased. It has never been liberated, it has never been deluded. It has never existed, it has never been non-existent. It has no limits at all, it does not fall into any kind of category. Trichin Kenambacha said, profound and tranquil, free from complexity, uncompounded luminous clarity, beyond the mind of conceptual ideas, this is the depth of the mind of the victorious ones. In this, there is not a thing to be removed, nor anything that needs to be added. It is merely the immaculate looking naturally at itself.
Why is it that people should find it so difficult even to conceive of the depth and glory of the nature of mind? We have been taught to spend our lives chasing our thoughts and projections. Even when mind is talked about, what is referred to is thoughts and emotions alone. And when our researchers study what they imagine to be the mind, they look only at its projections. No one ever really looks into the mind itself, the ground from which all these expressions arise, and this has tragic consequences. How can we now turn this situation around? It is very simple. Our minds have two positions, looking out and looking in. Let us now look in. The difference that this slight change in orientation could make is enormous. I might even reverse those disasters that threaten the world. When a much larger number of people know the nature of their minds, they'll know also the glorious nature of the world they're in, and struggle urgently and bravely to preserve it. It's interesting that the word for Buddhist in Tibetan is Nangpa. It means insider, someone who seeks the truth not outside, but within the nature of mind. All the teachings and training in Buddhism are aimed at that one single point, to look into the nature of the mind, and so free us from the fear of death, and help us realize the truth of life. Spiritual truth is not something elaborate and esoteric. It is, in fact, profound common sense. When you realize the nature of mind, layers of confusion peel away. You don't actually become a Buddha. You simply cease, slowly, to be deluded. And being a Buddha is not being some omnipotent spiritual superman, but becoming at last a true human being. What the Buddha saw when he became enlightened was that ignorance of our true nature is the root of all the torment of samsara, and the root of ignorance itself is our mind's habitual tendency to distraction. To end the mind's distraction would be to end samsara itself. The key to this, he realized, is to bring the mind home to its true nature through the practice of meditation. Generally, we waste our lives, distracted from our true selves, in endless activity. Meditation, on the other hand, is the way to bring us back to ourselves, where we can really experience and taste our full being beyond all habitual patterns. To meditate is to make a complete break with how we normally operate, for it is a state free of all cares and concerns, in which there is no competition, no desire to possess or grasp at anything, no intense and anxious struggle, and no hunger to achieve, an ambitionless state where there is neither acceptance nor rejection, neither hope nor fear. A state in which we slowly begin to release all those emotions and concepts that have imprisoned us into the space of natural simplicity. The Buddhist meditation masters know how flexible and workable the mind is. If we train it, anything is possible. With time, patience, discipline, and the right training, our mind will begin to unknot itself and know its essential bliss and clarity.